cliffcentral.com.
Good morning to all our listeners. Thank you for joining us on Wedding Central this morning. And today, myself and Ntombi are joined today by Brenda and Kylie from the Stewart Gardner Attorneys. Welcome.
Yes, thanks, ladies.
Hello. So excited today because this is a topic that I think a lot of couples don't actually address. I think it's actually a very awkward topic. Doing an anti-nuptial agreement, or what's commonly known as a prenup, is a huge contentious issue with clients. And I've even seen clients who, during the wedding planning process, even call off the wedding because now this prenup has kind of come into play, and families are now at war because now everyone wants to get involved, and you know, it becomes very, very sticky. What do you find is the common misconception about anti-nuptial contracts?
I think the biggest misconception is that it's to plan for divorce.
Mm.
And that it's unromantic, and you plan for divorce, and there's no need, and we're all in love, and it's insulting to the other party to now have this discussion about what's yours and what's mine. And that is not at all true.
Yeah.
At all. Mm. I think the fundamental thing that people don't understand is that the dress these days gets trashed or put in a cupboard or refashioned.
Mm.
The photographs go on a wall. The cake gets eaten. The one thing that lasts the entire duration of your marriage, be it ending by death or divorce,
right,
is your anti-nuptial contract.
Yeah, they say it's the two D's.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But it's not a divorce contract. It's a divorce thing.
Yeah.
And Tommy, I'm quite interested to see, to hear that a lot of your families, the couples' families get involved. Like my couples, I know it's the two of them and that's it. How do you find that happens?
So I think the conversation comes up, especially where, and I think because I deal with a lot of maybe black clients,
yeah,
I think that cultural dynamic comes into play. The conversation comes up about anti-nuptial agreements or whatever the case is, and people immediately start considering inheritance or, you know, the bigger picture. So I might not have anything, he might not have anything, we're in love, it's fine, my love, we'll see how we go, you know, further down the line. And then the parents get involved because, you know, they're like, wow, you know, this inheritance. And
is it a new thing amongst African clients, African brides?
It's definitely
couples,
I think African clients as a whole, anti-nuptial agreements are very new. I think in the last 10 years it really has only started to become something that is spoken about, whether they agree to do it or they don't or whatever. It is only recently, and I mean 10 years is a long time, but it's very recent if you look at the bigger scheme of how long this anti-nuptial agreement thing has been perhaps around.
And aside from that, I think the financial obligations of black people within their family environment is very different from the traditional white family concept, which deals with what's yours and what's mine, and we might have inheritance from one grandparent or two.
Yeah.
When you're in a far more vast familial environment, there are a lot more obligations to consider.
Sure.
And you might not want to just narrow it down to a new married couple.
Sure.
So there's a lot of pressure, I think.
It's so different.
Yeah. And what Brenda's referring to is a lot of people, we call it black tax. That's
black tax.
Yeah, we call it black tax. And it's literally being taxed by your family where, you know, I'm married and I have my own house or whatever, but I'm still obliged to pay for my aunts and my uncles and their kids to go to school. And like, you just have to kind of keep supporting the family, and you have to kind of keep it going because somebody else most likely paid for you to go to school. And like, that whole community family brings up a child.
It's amazing. I think it's fabulous.
Yeah.
I really do.
I mean, to an extent, but I feel like in this day and age where life is very expensive, it kind of becomes ridiculous. I mean, we're no longer in the age where people can afford to even just have one income in the house.
Yeah,
so now everyone goes to work, and you know, kids are going to private school, and now if you imagine, shucks, now I have to send somebody else's child to, I mean, it just it's an affordability thing. So definitely I'm glad that Brenda brought that up. In terms of the actual anti-nuptial agreement,
yes,
as a couple, what would you say is the best way to kind of I don't want to say prepare, but what do I need to keep in mind? Now, if we're going to have this discussion, what really is the crux, or what is this antenuptial agreement supposed to do? If it's not for divorce and it's not for preparing for the world, like what exactly is this thing for?
Well, I think a very long-term view needs to be taken, because when you are engaging in a marriage, it is with a long-term view. Hopefully, it's with a long-term view. But that doesn't mean that you look at the future without looking at the present. Mm. It's about isolating what it is that you've got now, and in order and looking at what your professional life is likely to be. Mm. Where it all started, I think, was back in the day, you could get married in community of property.
Yeah, so let's explain the two. I think I would take it a step back.
Right.
What are the ways in which a couple can get married?
All right. Well, there are three ways. Mm-hmm. Two and a half.
Okay.
The traditional way was you got married in community of property. Mm-hmm. And everything is then shared in one pot. And it's not just what you accumulate through the duration of your marriage, it is everything past as well. So if you got married at 18 or 20 and you both had nothing, and you were aiming towards a particular goal, then it's a very equitable way to get married. But people start getting married older and older. They've got individual assets. Now you've got to share all of that through the in community of property.
And debts.
Everything.
And I think that's
everything.
A big thing.
I mean,
a lot of people don't mind sharing what they've got because they love their spouse.
Yeah. Correct.
At that moment.
But it's the debt that can be the bigger issue.
Exactly. So from an equity perspective, It's not bad. From a risk perspective, it's terrible. Because you are exposing each other and your future and your children and everything to the possibility of the external world trying to get a bite at that pie.
Yeah.
So, you know, if there is someone who's in independent business, and we were saying earlier that's happening more and more and more, and the business fails and their creditors, then your house is at risk.
Yeah.
Everybody's income is at risk. Everything that your in community of property spouse has built up in 20 years is at risk. So if you are especially in independent business or in a high risk environment, it's important to ring fence and protect that asset base as much as possible. So then they brought in the concept of an antenuptial contract,
right?
Which means what's yours is yours and what's mine is mine.
And it's in no way negative.
You know, it's
a lot of people look at this as a negative thing. It's not. It's just to protect certain things.
And certain donations can be taken care of in terms of the antenuptial contract. It doesn't in any way limit your ability to live as a happy, productive couple. No way. It gets a little tricky, and there might be arguments about money down the line if one spouse, for example, has stayed home to raise children and has not had the opportunity to acquire an estate. But then there are other pieces of legislation that assist.
Right.
It does mean you run up and down to court quite a lot.
I think that must be a big challenge for you as a lawyer to deal with
the maintenance issues. So in 1984, that's when they revolutionized the antenuptial contract concept, and they introduced something called the accrual system.
Right.
Which basically says you enter into an antenuptial contract, the basis of which, the main reason for which, is to protect your estates from the world at large and from each other's creditors.
Okay.
But you can set a starting value, which might be null if you're starting out or you want to share everything. But everything that is accrued during the duration of that marriage is split. So you have a right, even if you haven't earned the actual physical money, to a portion of that by virtue of your marital system.
So if you're a business owner, you value your business before you go into contract, then your business grows, then what is that?
You can exclude it entirely.
Okay.
And you find some business owners are obliged in terms of the company documentation that they've got with their other shareholders
to keep it separate.
Yeah.
There are then, of course, that's another whole show, is the commercial contracts that protect a family in that scenario.
Yes. Right.
But from an antenuptial contract perspective, a lot of those are excludable assets. And that is a lot of argument.
Right, right. Yeah. And I think it's important, or maybe the question maybe that I want to ask is, how long can this thing be? Because I think maybe people have, I mean, you know, do I get 388 pages or, you know, is it a one pager? And you know, how particular, perhaps, yeah, maybe that's the question, how particular can an antenuptial agreement actually be? Because, you know, obviously I think Hollywood has also spoiled us. And, you know, you hear they say, oh, no, this one gets paid out if this one doesn't cheat for a year. And blah, blah, blah. Like, it's very extreme. So how particular?
It can be very particular. The difficulty is people don't generally like attorneys. Mm. They're intimidated by the legal system, right, which is unfortunate because most of our legal system is actually quite user-friendly if you've got the right interpretation. But people don't like having to go to an attorney. Mm. Where they would rather go and see a florist or a dress designer.
Right.
But
it's a very formal thing when it comes to planning of a wedding. You know?
And also, attorney just makes you feel like, oh my God, like... Oh my God.
Things are getting serious.
I'm never going to survive this.
Correct. But it doesn't have to be 388 pages. Of course, we have had situations where it's turned into a week-long negotiated contract.
Mm.
And like you say, weddings then sometimes don't happen.
But it must cause a lot of stress on that planning process.
It can, but Gentle. there's also maybe a little bit of a warning sign there.
Right.
Marriage is tough.
Yeah.
If you can't deal with what you're actually contemplating in the space of 3 or 4 pages and an hour or two with your attorney, maybe you need to re-examine where it is that you're planning on going as a couple.
Yeah, 100%. And with that being said, how far in advance should a couple start perhaps considering, you know, going to see an attorney for their antenuptial agreement? Because, you know, I have a lot of clients and, you know, even at my first meeting, it's kind of the first question I ask, you know, have you considered how you're going to get married? Do you want me to recommend an attorney? How do you want to go about it? And they say, oh, we'll speak about it further down the line. And, you know, 6 months in, then you have these explosions. So how far in advance?
I think it depends on the couple as well and how long they've been together and if they've lived together, if they run joint accounts, if it's quite a new relationship that they're wanting to formalize. I think our rule of thumb, and every little diary and book that you read has got a different, you know, do
different.
This 6 months.
Right.
We don't like to do it sort of shorter than about 3 months beforehand.
Right.
I say the earlier the better.
Always.
Absolutely.
Because
always.
It does, if there are any issues, it can be ironed out long before.
Yeah.
Exactly. And the families don't get involved and, you know, there's not that emotion.
Yeah. And also I feel like for me it's more of a commitment. You know, once you've signed that contract,
they're
really in it.
Yeah.
Like, we are getting married.
And Tombi, you joke, and I think I've mentioned this before, but we signed ours the day before. I mean, come on, a wedding planner. They say a plumber always
stressful.
Has a leaking toilet.
Yeah, cobbler's children.
Wow.
You know, and I cried the day that I signed it. It's not because I was nervous or anything. I think it was obviously emotions as well, but it was legit. I saw that as the marriage contract. It wasn't like the signing of the register on the day. It was that day was just such an important moment for me. It was so I would say earlier the better, and just so your emotions don't get the better of you.
Correct.
It's tricked off.
And get it off your desk because there are so many other things that require attention. But like we say, it's not about getting divorced.
Right.
There are very many contracts and documents you'll sign throughout your life and your married life.
Oh, scary.
The next thing, of course, you're going to consider is a will.
Right.
And your antenuptial contract will indicate how your will is going to be, you know, administered.
Yeah. Do you do that? Do you do wills as well?
We do.
We should do that as a different discussion.
To a point.
Yeah.
Deceased estates is quite a specialist area.
Mm-hmm.
For existing clients and that sort of thing, we do.
Mm-hmm.
It's incredibly administrative.
Yeah.
It's incredibly time intensive, and you've got to deal with the master of the High Court, which is a challenge.
Sure.
So, yes, we do, but always in conjunction with someone who does it on a daily basis.
Yeah.
Where that's their specialty.
Correct. Because if you've got someone there for 2 or 3 estates, then they might as well be there for 4 or 5.
Right.
If you've got someone there for 1, it's not a good use of anybody's time. But it indicates how that's going to happen. So nobody wants to pay tax, really.
Right.
Mm. Especially something like a stamp duty, which is a double taxation. Mm. So if you can reduce your exposure to it, an antenuptial contract is the perfect place to start.
Okay.
Because in terms of the accrual system, you retain that portion as a surviving spouse. You don't inherit it.
Mm.
So it's an exclusion to estate duty.
Yeah.
So it's an important thing to consider when you do your will.
Right.
Of course, you might have trusts for a house or whatever. So the antenuptial contract, although it's registered and it's very difficult to change once it is registered, it's only one of very many documents that are going to control the way in which you handle yourself financially going forward.
Right.
But it is a cornerstone in indicating how you interpret the other pieces of documentation.
Sure. I have a question. Before you even start the process, do you check the marital status of the person?
That's a very good question. And certainly the Home Affairs is putting more and more pressure on people to go and get a letter from them to check their marital status.
Yeah. You can. There's a number you can SMS.
SMS.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I've got the number. If you want to check your marital status, you SMS 48748 and then you put DHA space M and your ID number, and it'll send a message back saying, are you married?
Or
you'll find out, are you actually married?
Yeah.
Without even knowing.
You have those fraud cases where you're married to someone.
So
another country.
It's a really good one just to check your marital status before even going in.
And
definitely.
In fact, some marriage officers are requiring a letter from Home Affairs.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
To go and get it all sorted out, which is, it's a bit of a dichotomy in a country that has so much support for customary marriage and alternative, acknowledgement of union, to now go to Home Affairs and get something that says that you're not married.
Yeah.
Seems a little bit strange, but it is because there's so much fraud.
Fraud, 100%.
Yeah.
What can I expect to perhaps, what issues or what things will be considered when you start the antenuptial negotiation? Like what, because a lot of people, and I think this also becomes a issue of contention between couples, is things that you've tried to keep private, you now have to expose them where you had no intention of telling, perhaps that maybe you won the lotto, I don't know, whatever. But, you know, what issues can you expect to come to the forefront in that particular negotiation space?
Well, it's true. You're very raw and exposed in the process, and not just to your spouse that you trust, but possibly to an attorney that you've never met before.
Yeah.
It's, you are very raw. And I think if we were honest with each other, the primary reason marriages do break down is because of money.
Mm.
So the ability to have that discussion and be open about what it is that you're prepared to share and what it is that you believe should be secured against a potential sharing situation is an important conversation to be able to have. But it can lead to quite a lot of conflict.
Mm.
I would say, you don't want to have it too early with someone. Mm. But if you're engaged to someone, I think there's a fair indication. These days, you're generally living together.
Yeah.
So you're sharing a certain amount of expense. I think open cards about why you want to hold something back is important.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think the acceptance of the other party to understand that, especially if there is familial pressure, is important.
Mm.
There are certain things that are automatically excluded that people don't necessarily realize.
Okay.
Inheritance is automatically excluded from the accrual.
Okay.
So non-patrimonial damages. So if I'm in a car accident and I suffer pain and suffering and loss of limb, it's not a claim sounding in money.
Right.
That is for me because I'm the one who's injured.
Right.
And of course, then you have the right to hold back certain assets, exclude certain assets, or share a portion of assets.
Okay.
And the options are as varied and as many as the people who want to enter into this contract.
Sure.
There's absolutely no such thing as a standard ANC.
Okay.
We all work, of course, to a certain template because that is set out and ticks all of the requirements of the legislation that says this is what's required. But the individual requirements of each couple have got to be determined.
Yeah.
It's got to be an accurate reflection of what it is your intention at the time.
Mm.
And the recordal of that is very important. And that's where the attorney's role is also it's also fulfilled.
Yeah.
Couples don't necessarily write down why they think they're worth R1 million at the date of marriage.
Right.
And it's important to
do
keep that record.
Have to, okay, yeah. So the attorneys have to make sure that you...
Yes, and to keep it.
And do you have to? Don't you have to stipulate what your debt is at this point and...
Well, yes, you talk in terms of net assets.
Yes.
Yeah, so, so if you know, if you're going to exclude a house that's got a bond, you're excluding the possible benefit and the possible loss.
Yeah.
If you're only excluding the net asset portion, of course, then you both share in the risk and the profit of any accrual.
Right.
But it really is such an individual choice, and it really does require someone to sit down and ask those questions of you, because you don't often ask them of yourself or of a spouse, and you don't keep that record. So it is important.
It's a variant. I found it very interesting to go through.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm always one, like, I'm a talker. Like, I feel like I was born talking. So, you know, even with my husband, like, I have never had any issues talking about pretty much anything, but I'm aware that that's not the norm. It's not the norm to talk about money and to talk about issues. And I know that a lot of couples have issues with that particular dynamic. Specifically culturally, because families do perhaps, and I think, again, it is because of the typical understanding of an antenuptial agreement, even though it's incorrect. Who do I take with me, or who do I need to tell that I'm now going to do my antenuptial agreement? Yes, it's supposed to be an agreement between me and my potential husband and whoever else, but when family does get involved, why and to what extent, and, you know, how...
Oh. Why did you get family involved? It's so new to me.
And I think the issue is also people speak to their parents for advice, right? Yeah. You know, if you're really close with your parents and you go, oh, mom, tomorrow we're going to the attorneys or whatever, and she's absolutely
But you don't
not,
discuss your sex life.
You don't.
No, look, it is, and again, it depends upon the individual, how private you are, how you know, if it is something you discuss with your family, if you've been together for a long time, like lots of people are these days, and there's a you're already part of the same family,
right.
Then it's a bit easier, but you know, not everyone has been together for 10 years when they decide to get married, and they could have family overseas, and it's a little discomforting then maybe to have all of these opinions.
Yeah,
I would suggest that you maybe consult with an attorney and get all the information, make up your mind about what you want to do, and then maybe bounce it off other people to get an opinion.
Do you have a lot that the parents come?
No.
Okay, not at all.
No. No, in fact, I've only ever had one situation, and it was because the ANC was happening quite late. It was a very observant Jewish family.
Okay. Mm.
And, of course, in the last week, the couple's not supposed to have any contact at all.
With each other, yeah.
And the whole family got involved and there was a chance that things wouldn't progress because the families couldn't agree.
Mm.
And of course the couple couldn't talk to each other.
Yeah.
So that was quite tricky. So there again, sooner the better.
Yeah, 100%.
What's there's the antenuptial with accrual and then without, it's out and out.
Yes.
Are the...
Well, if you just enter into an ANC these days and you don't specifically exclude accrual, then it's automatically included.
Okay.
If you don't specify what your starting value is, then it's null, which means you share everything, even what you've got.
Mm.
But it protects you against creditors.
So that's with accrual?
With accrual.
Okay.
And then an ANC without accrual is a straight ANC. What's yours is yours. What's mine is mine. What I don't give you, you don't have a right to.
So even what you accrue in the marriage, if it's mine.
It's mine.
Can you imagine trying to, like, this is my couch, this is your couch.
Oh, my God. Yeah. And I think that's where the misconception starts, is that people feel like you're actually going to live in a house that's divided, where it's just like, this is my plate. I didn't let you.
So I think that the answer to that is twofold.
Mm.
The first is that the antenuptial the accrual portion, the antenuptial contract itself, operates until death or divorce.
Right. Mm.
So what's mine is mine, what's yours is yours until death or divorce, and only then is the accrual calculation done with regard to sharing.
I think a lot of attorneys go with out and out, isn't that correct?
A lot of business people do. A lot of business people do because you want to protect your family from the risk. Really, it was the accrual system was introduced so that those mums who stay at home and raise children are not prejudiced and are not at the mercy of the maintenance court.
Right.
And that they actually have a right to certain property that has been accumulated through the duration of the marriage.
Which is fair.
Which is fair.
Right.
I think the manner in which you choose to get married is largely determined upon age. If it's a first marriage and you're starting out and you've got very little, then accrual makes sense.
Yes.
It's the most popular choice among first-time spouses, couples. But if you are in your 40s or 50s, maybe it's a second marriage, maybe you've got children and financial obligations with regard to university, and you've each got your own independent estate, and then a straight ANC makes better sense because your earning really is behind you. Maybe you're looking at a joint retirement, but your situation is so significantly different that maybe the accrual is not going to be the important part of the marriage.
Yeah.
It's protecting children that you've already got, and you've already got your couches and your.
Yeah.
And so I think the age and status that you are at the time you're contemplating marriage plays a large role.
Does the will overpower the ANC?
No.
Okay.
No. Separate documents.
And separate documents altogether.
Yeah. And separate pieces of legislation, separate processes.
Wow. Okay.
Separate everything.
And now I want to get into the actual, perhaps the legalities of what this document needs to be.
Okay.
You know, I think it was a joke in a movie or something where people said, oh man, if you just sign on a napkin and put it in your pocket, it counts after the fact. You know? If you just say what's mine is mine or whatever, and you sign on a napkin.
Always in the movie.
You know, and it was just like, that's so ridiculous. But in terms of actually having a legal thing, you know, people think that, and again, I think it is misunderstanding what this thing is. People always say, oh, you're just signing a piece of paper. Mm. It should make it valid or whatever the case is. What are the actual, like, technicalities of the legality of this document?
Well, the first thing is that the document is registered at the Registrar of Deeds. Mm. So it is actually a formal registered document.
And does that have to be done before the wedding?
No.
Okay.
Thank goodness, because there's quite
South Africa after all, guys.
Although the deeds office is not too bad.
Right, okay.
It's not too bad, but it can, you know, imagine how many ANCs they've got to go through and register. You've got, as long as it's notarized before you get married, and it's in the protocol section of the notary public, and it's got a protocol number, that is what's required in order to get married.
Okay.
Then, so, and as long as that happens, then there's 3 months in which to register the document, but you got to do it quick smart, because if you do it on the last day of the third month, it might take 3 weeks to get through the registrar, and then you're in trouble.
And you give the couple a letter to the marriage officer.
Correct.
Yeah.
And often you find that then they want to buy a house together and they need a copy of their ANC and it's not registered yet.
Yeah.
So there are sometimes those timing issues. So again, the sooner the better.
Yes. Yeah.
Because then the sooner you get it into the registrar, the sooner you get it out. But if you are panicking and you decide on a Friday afternoon and you're getting married on a Saturday that you need an ANC, as long as it is notarized by an attorney who is also qualified as a notary public, who's got a special stamp and seal, then you're good to go.
Okay. So the thing with the notary, and I was just saying actually before we went on air, was that there was a wedding where I was involved in, and that morning the couple realized that shucks, they hadn't actually worked out. So they had started the process, but they hadn't agreed on a lot of elements, and they went to their lawyer's office, and the lawyer's office was like, right, or the attorney was like, right, everything's good to go. We don't have a notary. And who is supposed to find this notary? Should it be in terms of now I'm looking for an attorney and I'm looking to do this with my spouse, and now what am I looking for? What question should I be asking of my attorney to make sure that this is going to be an easier process for me?
Well, attorneys who do antenuptial contracts, if they're not notaries themselves, often have access to quite a few notaries. You should be able to find someone.
Right.
But sometimes, you know, if you're caught short on a Saturday morning, it's a little bit difficult.
Yeah.
It really is.
Since the wedding.
I would say then, you know, you're spending a lot of money on a wedding. Mm. You don't want to necessarily not get married because you don't have an antenuptial contract. Mm. And this is very shaky ground to be on.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if you have a signed antenuptial contract but it's not notarized,
right.
There is a procedure that you can use, and it's set out in the legislation. Where
but not recommended.
Not recommended. You know, in the old days, you just signed a postnuptial contract and off you went.
Yeah. Yes.
That's no longer allowed. So you would automatically be married in community of property, but you've got a document now that evidences your intention. So if there's a fight about it, you've got at least something to go on. Then you would have to do an application, and it's a full substantive application to the High Court to change your marital status. Sure. So
even
it's
saying
not,
it,
it's not ideal.
It just sounds like, oh my gosh, why do that to yourself?
Well, I had a client who came in, consulted about the ANC. We had an appointment for them to come on the Friday and sign it all. And they phoned and said, we can't. We're just popping off to the coast for a weekend. We'll do it on Monday. And they came back and phoned me and said, guess what? We eloped. We got married on the weekend.
Oh,
can we make our antenuptial contract
no.
a postnuptial contract?
Oh, no.
And I had to say, no. We've got to now do a substantive application to court to amend your marital regime.
And that must also cause even more stress on the marriage afterwards.
And it's expensive. Mm. Yeah. But like I say, if you're spending millions on a wedding, you maybe don't want to lose all of that. Yeah. And if you're relatively sure that it's going to proceed and you're prepared to spend the additional money changing your marital regime, it's an option.
Mm.
But it's not recommended at all.
Right.
What should an antenuptial agreement cost? Yeah. What are the costs involved in that?
I actually wanted to ask, based on that submission that you do afterwards, that postnuptial, how much does that cost to change your regime?
Well, it depends upon the estates, because you've got to have a good reason. You've got to advertise to all of your mutual creditors and independent creditors.
Oh, my God.
You've got to notify SARS. There's a lot.
Oh, my God.
It's obviously like, I just can't.
Dead.
It's got to be in the High Court because it's changing your status, which means you get an advocate involved, and you're lucky if you get one of those at a reasonable rate.
What's reasonable, advocates?
Well, I don't know.
Good question.
I don't know.
Shut.
So it can be quite a production. Mm. It's always it does add.
And it's unnecessary. You know, if you just planned ahead, you spend all this money and you plan so much for a wedding, why leave that?
Exactly.
The sooner the better.
And everyone thinks attorneys are so expensive, and it's such a grudge purchase.
Yeah, really, grudge purchase is the perfect word.
It's a grudge purchase. Yeah. But if it's relatively simple and straightforward, and you've had the discussions, and you know what it is that you want, we charge a basic fee of 2,650 rand.
Oh, come on.
For the antenuptial
contract. For the straight ANC.
Okay. Before the wedding.
Before the wedding.
Yes.
It includes the deeds office registration fee. It includes the notary's fee.
Sure.
And it means you don't have to pay 260 rand here and 200 rand there. It's a single invoice. It's like a once, and we handle then everything.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, if we're going to need to consult for 3 hours and they're going to be 15 drafts, that is revised.
Yeah.
Okay. But our basic fee, excluding the additional requirements, is 2,650 rand.
And it's nothing in the greater scheme.
In the greatest. And it's also like you're buying peace of mind, which for me is also just priceless. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? For that kind of, it's done correctly, there's no issues or whatever that are going to crop up or pop up after the fact. I think it's easy.
For me, it's a no-brainer. If you are somebody who's got your own business, or you have to have one of these, because the last thing you want is that your business and your debts and maybe it goes under, that it affects your spouse and your children. And, you know, you just don't want that to happen.
No, you don't. And that I think you've underlined the primary intention.
It's just so simple. That's it. It's just to protect your family.
Correct. And that should be your primary motivation.
Yeah.
Is to protect the loved ones. You buckle your children into the car. You don't drive on bald tires.
Yeah.
Why would you get married in a risky way?
Yeah.
So it's not to discount the validity of other marital regimes, but I think the making an informed decision does take away some of the opportunity for conflict later on.
Sure. If somebody is not perhaps convinced, is there a chance or is there a charge if somebody wanted to consult, maybe with you even in general? Is there a general consultation fee if somebody wanted to perhaps ask a few questions? Because I find as a planner, and I'm sure Carly has this as well, I never want to, especially when the law is involved, I never want to advise you because people always take your word as the Bible, especially when you're a planner. They'll say, my planner said da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So correct. I always say, look, this is kind of the idea around it, but speak to somebody who knows exactly what they're talking about. But is there, you know?
Absolutely. There's always room for discussion beforehand. Mm. You don't want to make a rash decision and you want to make an informed decision.
Right.
So what we do is if you are interested, you can email us or drop us a message or whatever, and we give you information with regard to the different marital regimes, what the risks are, and it gives you a starting point for that conversation. Mm. If you do need to consult, then we prefer to do it on a one-on-one basis, and by that I mean determined by need.
Right.
You know, if there are lots of questions and that people have no idea and they're really confused about what it is that it could possibly be, we might need longer.
Right.
But some people come in and they only need 10 or 20 minutes. So it really is a bit of a sliding scale, and we'd prefer to quote according to need.
Right.
Because like Kylie was saying before we came on air, you do have people who will phone you 13 times a day with different questions.
Okay.
And it would actually serve everyone's interests better if they came in and had a comprehensive consultation, especially with their spouse.
Right.
Because now you're dealing with one person and you don't know what information is being fed through to the other spouse. And without that sort of transparency, it makes it very difficult to give cohesive advice.
Yeah. Sure. As somebody who, you know, maybe somebody who's listening and now they're planning their wedding and now for the first time they're really considering it, and you know how women are, we jot things out, I'm going to speak to my husband tonight or whatever the case is. What particular questions should be asked in the conversation that you have with your spouse? So like I'm hearing now that yes, you want to have conversations beforehand or whatever, and yes, you do give information, but for somebody to come to this consultation perhaps prepared,
yes,
what particular questions should be asked and what particular, maybe even documents, should we be bringing along to this consult?
Well, anything that was really considered an asset. So do you own fixed property?
Okay.
Do you own a house? Do you own a house in conjunction with someone? Do you own it with your brother or your father? Or yes. How do you own that property? Is it encumbered? Does it have a mortgage bond or whatever? How do you own your car? Is it financed? Do you own it outright? Pension funds. I mean, there's a whole issue around pension funds and how they operate. And the law has changed quite recently in terms of how that happens in a divorce scenario. But information with regard to independent portfolios, investments, pieces of art, pieces of jewelry, all of that sort of thing that is considered, you know, your granny's Persian carpet that everyone walks over every day but turns out might be worth 100,000 rand.
Right.
You might want to exclude it because in your will, you want to leave it to a direct family member.
Right.
Yeah. So, you consider your current situation but also looking forward. Is there anything particular that that is dealt with in terms of another will? Is there a fideicommissum? Am I only entitled to a portion of what I've got and I've got an obligation to send it on somewhere else?
Yeah. So like that Persian carpet, like if you do not stipulate that in your antenuptial contract and say you pass away,
it would fall into the accrual.
Sure.
Unless you've specifically dealt with it.
Excluded.
You know, there are ways in your will, obviously, that are going to ease out. So if your surviving spouse doesn't care what you do with the carpet and you've bequeathed it to someone in terms of your will, as long as they get their rand amount of their accrual, it doesn't have to be half the carpet.
Right.
But they have a right, and they've got a right to half the value.
Okay.
Depending upon the accrual. Mm. And you know, we use half. Quite liberally, but it's not actually half.
Earlier you mentioned that it's very difficult to change a prenuptial agreement. What happens if, when I started out, it was like this, and now 15 years on, I want to now add this carpet? What do I need how do you know what I mean? Like, is there a way? Are you like, do you, because you know, I can imagine people get married quite young and you don't think of perhaps particular things, and
you
now
you see the value of a person,
and you know, now you really, and I think a lot of people's mindsets change, especially when they have kids. It's not so much when you're living as a couple, but I think it's when you have kids and now people want to pass on certain things or whatever. Now they're just like, shucks, I didn't actually mention it 10 years ago, whatever the case is. What What are my options?
You would have to, I think, make an application to amend your marital regime. Sure. Oh. So if you were married by a cruel, for example, and now or there are all sorts of things that you would want to exclude, you would probably have to make application to have the cruel portion removed from your antenuptial contract.
Oh.
I think that's probably the way you would have to go because it's a registered document.
Mm.
You certainly can't change it unilaterally. Mm. I think that the other way to do it would be to have an independent agreement between the two of you with regard to what would happen, and it needs to be lodged then with your will. So someone says, I understand.
Okay.
And of course, if you've inherited it after you were married, it's automatically excluded.
Okay.
From
that's what I was just going to ask. Yeah. If it's inherited, then it's
but
excluded.
I'm thinking if you want to give, like perhaps you have a ring from your mom and you were going to have it forever, and then you have a daughter all of a sudden and you're like, shucks,
but it was
I want to pass
it.
Was it?
Inheritances beforehand can be quite tricky. You often find that inheritances say, you know, you can, all inheritances in your will are subject to, they will not fall into any community of profit and loss, any accrual, all of that sort of thing. But you don't want to be in a position where you have to prove what the scenario
was.
Yeah. It's better to record it if you can.
Okay. Yeah.
So all of those are important questions. When people come along and they've got, I've got a car, but they forget that they've got, you know, a unit trust portfolio.
Mm. Yeah.
But that's maybe why it is important to get the family involved. Mm. What is my inheritance? Do you discuss that beforehand?
Not necessarily. Okay. I mean, if it's inheritance that you've already got,
but maybe you don't know what you're inheriting.
Yeah. You know what I wanted to ask was...
I would hope that you would, but
I don't know what I'm inheriting.
No, but you're already married, so it would happen after you're married, so it's an automatic exclusion.
Yeah. So my question is, something like that for me is kind of like, is fine, because that means like if the person dies and they leave me stuff, then that stuff is automatically excluded. What about if I am, you know, living my own life and I'm working wherever and I'm included perhaps in a family business? Perhaps I'm not even aware, but maybe they've written it like I'm a shareholder, whatever. I'm not aware, but they are running this business and all of the kids are part of the business, even if we're not like in the operations. What happens then? Because again, if I'm not aware that I'm part of a business and I just carry on and I do, you know?
Well, the commercial attorney in me is freaking out completely.
Why do you not know these things?
Oh, cracky.
And it could be stuff that, you know, and I've heard this before. I've had a client who their mom started a business when they were born, and the mom actually named the business after this child, but this child then grew up to have nothing to do with this business whatsoever. And yes, of course, she thought, of course, she might inherit whatever the case is, but she didn't think she was a part of the business because people just register, because all you need is an ID number and a copy, and that's the end. So what happens if you aren't aware of something like that? And, you know,
it's a very good question. I would say then that there would have to be some, once it comes to your attention, there would have to be some element of agreement.
Okay.
Often you find in a business scenario when you do have shareholders, it's catered for in what's called a buy and sell agreement. So people who are shareholders of a company don't want their partner's spouse, who inherits the shares in terms of a will, to be a shareholder in the company. Because, they might not have an interest and it just complicates things. So they have insurance policies where the money pays out to the surviving spouse and to the estate and the surviving spouse in terms of the will. And the shares fall back into the company to the other insured shareholders. So you're not necessarily then a share, but then that money becomes an issue because it falls into the estate.
Yes.
So it's a very thorny question.
Yeah.
And it's not something that you can necessarily change in your ANC.
Yeah.
But there can be, I think, an independent contract between the parties with regard to how that was going to be dealt with.
Okay.
And that would be legit if you had to do a separate contract.
You might have to end up defending it in court.
Yeah.
But what it would do
gives it a bit of clout.
Yeah, I mean, if you're part of like the Hilton group and then all of a sudden that, I mean, it's millions. Shucks, we're going to court.
Absolutely.
I am on my way.
That being said, how much time do you want to spend in court proving your position?
Yeah.
If you've got a document that indicates what the intention of the other party is, you're going to cut your time in court down.
Right.
And time in court is expensive. expensive. You don't want to be arguing about who said what after the third glass of wine in that restaurant.
Right.
You want something that says, concrete. This is what my intention is. I understand it. I agree to it. It's not ideal.
Mm.
It is the sort of thing that maybe should be discussed up front. I would love someone to pop out the woodwork and say, here you go, you're a 30% shareholder.
Yeah.
And here's your dividend and off you go.
Yeah.
I think it's unlikely.
Yeah.
But there again, if you are concerned, you can do a search at the company's office to see if you are a director. It makes it difficult to see shareholding, but at least you have an idea of whether or not someone has put you on as the director.
Yes, unknowingly. So,
Not necessarily with shareholding, but in most smaller companies, you find people who are directors are also shareholders.
Right.
So it's an indication. Mm. So there are other ways that you can investigate your own financial holding before you proceed. But I would hope that you wouldn't have to do that.
Sure. It's quite mind-boggling, hey? But you know what I think? And the reason why we've brought you in here is that we don't want to see it as a divorce contract or anything like that. It's just a very important document in your life that you have to consider.
Yeah. And even if you choose not to go ahead with it, at least you've had the opportunity to make the choice.
100%.
Which means down the line, you do have, you know, it does take a little bit of the conflict out of it.
Yes. Right.
Knowledge is power.
Yeah.
And what we do find is that there are people down who didn't know and would have made different decisions.
Choices, yeah.
And it doesn't have to be intimidating.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be expensive. But it should be considered.
Yeah.
It's the kindest thing you can do for the person that you love.
100%. Look, I love conversations like this. And I always say, you know, to my clients, especially in this day and age, you have a lot of young clients who actually don't follow a particular faith as well.
Mm.
So they don't even go through like the premarital counseling and that kind of thing. And I always say, if you're not going to do premarital counseling, then you definitely need a prenup, because it's definitely going to force you to deal with issues that perhaps you never would have.
I wish our legislation actually required it.
Yes.
Because it is such a value. And if you're not if you're not religious or faithful and you don't have a rabbi or a priest,
some kind of
or
a guiding,
someone who can guide you, you should. There are family psychologists who specialize and who will take you through the discussions that you need, especially in interfaith marriages.
That's it.
It becomes very thorny.
Yeah.
Do you celebrate Christmas or not?
Yes. I mean, it can be just as simple as that. Brenda, if somebody wanted to get hold of you, how do they get hold of you?
The best way is probably by email.
Okay.
And that's nice and easy.
Yeah.
It's my name.
Okay.
Which is not a nice, easy name at all. And if I knew half about email now, as I know now, as I did when I started, I would never have chosen this email address.
Right.
But it's brenda@stewart-garden.co.za.
Okay.
And that's Stewart, the old fashioned Stewart.
Yes,
before Mary Queen of Scots came along and changed the name. That's the best way. We also have a Facebook page, which is Stewart Garden Attorneys.
Fabulous.
And we've got a Twitter account, SGA Attorneys.
Lovely. Yeah. You know what? I think what's so nice is you're not as scary as that.
That's a good thing.
I think people have a picture of an attorney being literally in like all the garb. And I think people actually have a picture of an advocate. You know, when they're wearing the gowns and the white hair, and people think that
you know what,
that's who I'm going. Like, I'm going to meet the judge. Like,
do you know what? I think that's why I was so emotional about. I had a fiery redhead lady had helped with my mother-in-law's divorce.
Oh,
and it was just, she was hectic and she was up there, and I was like, oh my god, it was so hectic. So actually, speaking to you, Brenda, it's just, you make me feel so much more relaxed.
Yeah.
I should put Kylie's photo everywhere, because and you know, the thing is it doesn't have to be scary.
Not at all. Yeah.
You know, it really does.
Yeah, I always say to my clients, look, it's not going to kill you. I think people think like this is the end. Like, you are going to survive. You're going to eat afterwards. You will be fine.
And just because you visit the attorney doesn't mean they're going to stick a pen in your hand and make you sign.
Yeah,
It just creates the interactive conversations that need to be had.
Yeah.
And you're going to have them at some point.
Yeah, I mean, you have to.
You
have to.
And it might be at the very end. Where you've got the scary red-headed divorce attorneys involved.
Yeah, I think that's something you've also got to look at. Like, you would choose your planner, you would go and meet a few. You need to find who works better with you. And, you know, you'd rather for ANC, go to a company that specializes in anti-nuptial contract, not necessarily divorces. You know what I mean?
I mean, we're a general practice. Mm. And I would say primarily we actually founded more in commercial and litigation work.
Okay.
Which means, aside...
Let's be people.
Correct, but attorneys. also we see the ramifications of not doing paperwork properly up front.
Yeah.
Yes. And so we see the other side of it.
Yeah.
So it is important to have someone who doesn't just look, you know, tunnel vision at the ANC, but the bigger picture. So we do all of that.
Do you find that it's a long relationship after? Like, you know, now you've signed your prenuptial agreement and that kind of thing, but do you find that now these people are with you for the next, I don't know, 30 years or whatever the case is?
Oh, we hope so. We hope so.
That's the idea. Look, thank you so much, Brenda and Kylie, for coming in. It's been an absolute pleasure having you in. I know we've spoken about a lot of other topics that we're going to bring you in for, and we're very, very excited. For our listeners, I hope that you've found something very informative from this and that you do think about really doing an antenuptial contract with your spouse. All the best, and find us on social media, #WeddingCentral. CliffCentral.com.